listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host and mom, Caroline.
Another nice day.
Another beautiful start to a beautiful weekend if you're listening to us on Friday. And if you're listening to us on the rebroadcast 8 a.m. Monday morning, welcome to another beautiful June week.
And we hope that in the mean between Friday and Monday it rained.
We certainly do. But not at 5 p.m. on Saturday when we have our All Things Italian Festival going on here in Fairfield.
Right.
Yeah, and that draws up to 5,000 visitors or people.
Wow.
Hanging out in our town square.
Wow.
And enjoying gelato and lasagna and Neapolitan pizza and
biscotti?
Biscotti, cannoli?
Cannolis.
Cannolis, yeah. All those wonderful things, plus all kinds of Italian entertainment.
Oh, it'll be a blast.
If you're one of our internet listeners and you're not close to Fairfield, come on anyway.
Hop a plane.
Come on down.
Hop a plane.
So, Mom, you want to introduce our wonderful guest today?
I do. This lady is Christine Carlson. And, excuse me, she captivated readers worldwide with her first three bestsellers, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love, and Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Women, and An Hour to Live, An Hour to Love, The True Story of the Best Gift Ever Given. These books are amazing. They really are. The one we're doing today is Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms, Simple Ways to Stress Less and Enjoy Your Family More. And I think everyone would like to do that. I really do.
Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Christine.
Hey, thank you so much. Good morning.
Well, it's afternoon here.
Oh.
So you must be on the Pacific Coast.
I'm on the West Coast, yes.
That's right. All right. Well, good morning to you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Well, Christine, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms is the first book in this series in how many years?
In 9 years.
9 years. And what made you decide to go back and extend the series at this point?
Well, let's see. I think there were a lot of reasons to go into this series right now. One of the main ones was just to keep the series current to current issues and current things that people are concerned with in general. With 9 years passing and the popularity of this series being so great, it just made a lot of sense to look into adding a book to the series. And the mom's book wasn't done for the series, and mostly because I was completely overwhelmed and responsibilities of being a mom. When you're in it, it's just you're so in it. And, I really wanted to live it and be in it. I didn't want to analyze it too closely any more than I had to on a day-to-day basis with my own children. And, of course, I had so many questions at that time of my life. And at this time, with two grown children, 20 and 23, and two grandchildren, I definitely, like most moms at this stage of the game, feel like I have a lot of the answers. So,
I don't know.
given the philosophy of the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff wisdom, I just, really felt that this was the right book to add to the series and just to give the energy, positive energy to the series. My husband passed away really suddenly in 2006 from a pulmonary embolism, and there's just been a lot of healing to be done, and I think that my own life wisdom has increased 10 to 100 fold from going through grief, and what I have to offer is so extensive to moms and to women in general. So this was a really perfect book for me to write at this time in my life, and hopefully it resonates with a lot of moms out there.
Well, it certainly did with me. I have five children and 11 grandchildren, another one on the way. And,
yay!
Yeah. And
you got that a little wrong. You had 11 grandchildren, one great-grandchild.
One great-grandchild and another great-grandchild on the way.
On the way.
Yes, yes.
Got to get credit here for being a grandma.
Right, I'm sorry.
Absolutely, a great-grandma to boot.
Yeah, I got confused. Well, I don't feel great yet, But but he is a dynamo for sure. And
Oh, yeah. She's talking about my first grandson, who's now two.
Oh, wow. And, yay.
Yeah. And, oh, man, he has more energy than you could. If you could bottle it, if we could bottle it, we'd be rich.
We would. We'd be millionaires.
For energy, or do you think that we just have less and it appears to be more than when our kids were that little? I think we just forget.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah, that might be. Yeah.
That could be. It is amazing, though, how, you know, he does things that remind me so much of his father at that age. And, you know, how much similarity there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's just so much genetic carry through. My first grandson reminds me of my husband. I mean, much of my husband. I mean, you know, just the way he looks, the looks on his face, the way he moves, you know, there's so many similarities. It's just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, sometimes Monica's brothers, she has three brothers, and they remind me of their dad, who died quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And, but sometimes it's kind of spooky.
Because
one of them is so much like him. I mean,
yeah, he is.
Yeah. But anyway, well, you know, the circle of life.
And you're right about the genetics, because my son reminds me a lot of my father a lot of times. And mm-hmm. he barely knew him, because my son was only four when my dad passed away.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So it's all. The qualities are genetically, you know,
passed along
in that case. Yeah.
Yeah, there's such a gift in that, and especially after you've gone through such a loss as we have, you know, when you get to see that return mm-hmm. of that person, even though their own person, they're
right.
not the same person at all, they're going to be their very own person, but yeah. it's just so beautiful to see that cycle of life, and it really has given me so much joy and so much hope for a future.
Oh, I know. I know. I understand what you're saying. Exactly.
Now, Christine, your husband was Dr. Richard Carlson, and can you tell us a little bit about how, you know, I believe he wrote the first Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book?
Is yeah, back in 1997, Richard's story, our story, was kind of your very typical overnight success story. It took 10 years. It was Don't Sweat the Small Stuff was his 10th book. And, you know, prior to that, he was an up-and-coming popular positive psychology author, kind of one of the first people, one of the first doctors to write on happiness. He wrote a book called You Can Be Happy No Matter What back in 89. And that book became very popular after his Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series took off, because really that book is the foundation of the entire work that he's done. And really there's five principles that he narrowed it down. Well, he didn't, but he studied and he, you know, figured out with a bunch of other people that there were five principles to keeping life in perspective, and they were really all about understanding your thoughts and your moods and your feelings and that we live in separate realities, and to understand that present moment living is probably the most powerful thing that any of us could do. And with those principles, he pretty much wove those principles throughout all of his work and his books, and he included me in the series in Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love in 2000. So it was about the fourth book in the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series, and we wrote that one together, and it was Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love. And then after the success of that book, the publisher asked me to write Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Women, in which I really asked the question at that time, with our kids being young, I asked the question, do I have to? I really wasn't sure I wanted to, you know, I wasn't sure I wanted to dive into a writing career that I hadn't really ever dreamed up myself. You know, I was incredibly, you know, happy to be the support person of my husband's career, but wasn't particularly sure that that was a career that I endeavored to aspire to. And I didn't have to write the book, but Richard highly encouraged me to, because he said if I didn't write it with him, then he'd have to ask another woman, because it was a book for women.
Ah.
Oh, yeah.
And then he assured me, it was very sweet, he assured me that I didn't have to worry, that this was a Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book, and that I lived this stuff, and that this came out of the chapters of our lives, and that there was no other woman that was more qualified to write it, and he had me right by his side, and he said, I'll be there holding your hand, and, you know, if you have any questions or anything, I'm right there. And So I did, and the beautiful thing was my editor, as I started to write, she told me, she said, you're like an otter that's taken to water. You know, you are a writer. It's amazing that there's two writers in the same household. And she said, you've got what it takes to be a writer if you want to be one. And so basically I wrote that book with, you know, on my own with his help, and I pretty much just put it aside, and I went back to my job as a mom and supporting him, and didn't really pick up writing again until his passing in 2007, in which I published a book called An Hour to Live, An Hour to Love, which was a tribute back to him, publishing a love letter that he wrote to me, answering the question, if you had an hour to live and could make one phone call, who would it be to, and what would you say? And I published that back to him, and Oprah had us on as a tribute to Richard's work and his really great life to the world. So it was a beautiful start, really, you know, to a new career for me.
Now, when your husband passed away, did you have an hour, or did you have no time?
He had written that to me on our 18th wedding anniversary, 3 years before his passing. Mm. And I was looking for a way to give him a national tribute, because with 25 million copies of his books in print, you know, he had a lot of fans out there, and I wanted him to have the kind of tribute that he deserved. And so I published that letter, which was really so beautiful, as everything that he would say that mattered to him in his last hour of life. And it was everything he'd say to me, but it was more than that. It was all of his values, all of his authentic values were in that letter of 37 pages. And I published it back to him with my response in it 4 months after his death.
Oh, wow. Well, that must
be really powerful. It's a very powerful little book, a really powerful story, and, you know, just a beautiful thing that any man would think to write a letter. Richard wasn't sick or ill or anything, you know, and he did this because it was in his heart to live very presently and to not leave anything unsaid. And I was so grateful, and will always be so grateful to him that he left this letter to me and my family.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
That really is wonderful, because so often when someone dies unexpectedly, you feel like there's things that were left unsaid.
Yeah, and certainly I felt like there might have been a few left unsaid on my part. but he definitely, you know, he definitely said everything he wanted to say. And he left 30 books to his name as well. He was quite a prolific writer.
30 books. Wow.
30 books.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible because he was only 45 when he passed. So.
Wow.
He was churning them out there, wasn't he?
He had so much inspiration. That man was just, like, he just got to the point where I could even be in the room with him and he could be listening to me and tapping in. You know, he just was so inspired all the time. I mean, it was really a beautiful thing to see.
Now, while he was writing, was he also a practicing psychologist?
You know, he practiced non-traditional psychology because he never got his MFCC because of the kind of psychology that he aspired to. So he practiced what he called happiness training for many years, about 10 years before he, you know, really hit it big, and then he didn't need to practice anymore. So at the time of his death, no, he was not a practicing psychologist any longer.
He didn't need to practice because he'd gotten good at it.
Well, he used to say he was a terrible therapist because he got people happy so quick. He was a terrible therapist because it only took him 10 sessions, and then he had them out, you know, out and happy again. And he was really a beautiful teacher in that way because he was such a content, happy person from the inside himself. He just kind of, you know, followed these principles and taught them, and people got it, you know. So that's why he knew his books were going to resonate with people, because the approach was very simple. It was really about accessing mental health and well-being, as opposed to looking at really what's wrong in your life, you know, kind of really reteaching people how to focus on what they have instead of what they want.
Now, do you know what brought him to, I mean, it sounds like his whole life was devoted to this, even before he was writing and, you know, when he was teaching
Yeah, you know, Richard was an All-American athlete, a tennis player, and a very successful, like, top five in the nation category tennis player when he was in high school and college. In fact, when he was at Pepperdine, he was slated number one, which was the number one team in the nation at the time. So he was a very driven man in all ways. And, you know, at that time in his life when he was young, he really picked up Wayne Dyer and different psychologists to really learn about his own psychology, because he felt that that would give him the cutting edge on the court. And so that was what inspired him initially. And then as he grew into really loving what he called the pop psychology movement, he just loved it so much that he, I think, really knew early on that his real game was going to be helping people get happy. And Richard named his dog, his first dog, Happy, when he was 12 years old. So it just kind of gives you a clue that, you know, he was sort of born a man with a mission. And he just had to remember, like the rest of us have to remember why we came to the earth, you know. And he came and he did what he was supposed to do. And unfortunately for all of us, he left early, you know. But I feel like he really, you know, he really accomplished his life on this earth. He really accomplished what he set out to do, and he really was a man of love and kindness. I mean, just oozed love and kindness. Wow. Just love him forever.
And he certainly left a legacy in his writings.
He did. He left an incredible legacy. Yeah. Incredible.
That will live for many, 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 many years to come.
Yeah, I mean, Richard today is still one of the top best-selling authors in the world, and after 5 years after his death, he's still among the top probably 10 best-selling authors in the world. So he's really created something that has a life far beyond his own, and he would have said, if you were interviewing him, that the measure of real success is that you create something that lives on after you. And I think that, you know, he would be real proud to know that he could walk away and everything would continue. The wheels would keep going without him, and that's a beautiful thing.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Christine Carlson, the author of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms, Simple Ways to Stress Less and Enjoy Your Family More. Well, Christine, what do you think it is about Don't Sweat the Small Stuff that hit with the public more than any of the other books that were maybe somewhat similar in topic that came before them?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things. One is the bite-sized short chapters, that format that Richard really pioneered. I mean, he wasn't the first to do it, but he was the first to really bring it to popularity. And, you know, the 700-word essay is so powerful, you know, because people, really, a lot of people don't have the tenacity or the patience anymore, unfortunately, to sit down and really immerse themselves in books the way they used to. And so I think that people really resonate with that short format. The other thing that made the series so popular was that, you know, Richard and our family really had the pulse on everyday life. That, you know, many of these chapters came from the chapters of our lives, from what bothered us, the things that we were good at, the things that we needed to improve. And, you know, he was really keen on observing those things and bringing them to life, and also giving people not only the problem but the solution to the problem, giving them a practice that what we have determined, you know, in our philosophy and our wisdom is that life itself is a practice. It's like a sport, and if you want to be good at it, you have to practice it the way you want it to be. And so the books are full of life practice that is doable, and people write all the time about, you know, how this book just made them feel so much more inspired about life. And it's because they would put these little things into practice, and they would really work in their lives. They would feel better.
Well, Christine, let's talk a little bit more about your writing, your involvement in the series, and your writing process. So,
well, you know, like I said, you know, earlier, I never really dreamed of being a writer. You know, I think as a child, I loved poetry. I have many journals of poetry. I would sit and write, and when I was at a lake, I would write poems for hours. And, you know, I did write. I loved writing essays, but I never dreamed of the career of being a writer. And so, I, you know, it's all been quite a big surprise to me on some level, you know, that that I have this voice, that it's kind of still shocking to me, you know. I'm still like, wow, I can't believe this is my life, because it is really cool. I didn't think I had the tenacity or the patience for writing, and I do. You know, what I have to do is really write via inspiration. I cannot sit down with an outline or a really strict structure. What I do every morning is I really have one prayer that I say in the morning after I have a quiet 10-minute practice of inspiration. And my prayer goes like this. It's, divine love, play me as an instrument in your finely tuned orchestra of life. And I ask to just be led to receive whatever it is I'm supposed to write today. And, you know, and then I just wait. You know, I wait to see what comes. And then I just, you know, start to key in something. An idea pops in. If it doesn't and I feel totally uninspired, I usually just don't even try too hard. I usually just put it away. But generally speaking, in the morning when I'm really still like that and I say that prayer, generally speaking, I have about a good hour to 3 hours of inspiration that I'm able to tap into. And if I do, then it usually just flows, and it's not really hard or hard work. It's just allowing this kind of feeling of whatever is supposed to come through me, come through me. And, you know, that's how I write. You know, that's I don't edit while I write. I just write. I edit later. So oftentimes I'll write whatever is I'm inspired to write, then I'll put it away, and I'll go back to it a day or two later and look at it. Mm-hmm. And then with fresh eyes, I'll go into it and tweak it and, you know, change things and change the structure of a sentence or change the flow or whatever, you know, whatever needs to be done to it. And that's kind of the system that really has worked really well for me. I have a very difficult time adhering to a strict structure. It kind of takes the fun out of it for me, mm-hmm. and I just, it really has to be inspirational for me to do it well.
Are you disciplined, though, about giving inspiration an opportunity every day?
Very disciplined, yes. When I'm on a deadline, I literally, every morning I wake up around 4 a.m., I get my coffee or tea, and I do my meditation, and I will, after my meditation, I'll do my prayer, and then I sit for a couple of hours, and then I have a workout routine after that. Like I'll sit for a few hours and I go to a workout class, or I work out, I go for a hike or something, and then I usually come back and I'll work a little more. So, you know, that's typically my routine. And I did notice, you know, when I wrote this book, I was sort of 3 days on, 2 days off. Like, if I really wrote like that for 3 days, I kind of felt empty, and then I would let myself have, you know, 2 days to regroup and refuel and just put it away and not look at it. Because that's the other thing, I think, that's when you're on a deadline for writing, the tenacity it takes is oftentimes more, you know, it's such an emptying process that, you know, sometimes it just feels like you're just completely zapped. Like, you just feel so like, oh my God, I feel like my body would just get almost a layer of something on it where I had to shake it off, you know? Because there's just so much information coming through, you know, and then after I would do that, you know, just allow myself a couple of days of space, I would notice that I'd be back in the flow again, and the flow of inspiration would come again, and it would feel easy again. And I'm just not a person, for me, like, I just can't do things that are just too hard. You know, if it's too hard, I just generally say, wow, this just isn't maybe the right time for me. And you know, and I was able to write this book in 6 months, and it, you know, I was really tenacious about it, and it's a pretty thick book for a Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book, because there's so much to say for moms. I mean, so much.
Well, it's 100 essays, and you say they're about 700 words each.
Some of them were more like 900 words, because I actually did put a few lists in some of the communication chapters, mm-hmm. and there's a few more lists in this book than most of them. Most of them are about 700-word essays, but I have a few lists in this book, which made the chapters a little bit longer.
Well, 100 times 700 is 70,000. That's a lot of words.
It is.
I'm an accountant, in case you can't tell.
It's a lot of words. It really is. When you think of it that way, you know, it's a lot to say. And yet this this kind of writing is such a beautiful approach, you know, because there is a formula to it, and, you know, it's not, once you get the formula, you pretty much, you stick to the formula, and you just move through, you know, move through each piece, and it's doable. It's very doable, but, you know, it takes tenacity, no doubt.
And you're writing from a very personal perspective.
Yes.
And when you said, you know, that after 3 days you felt kind of drained, I would think that that could contribute to that. You know, you're putting a lot of yourself on the page.
Oh, totally, yeah. And that, I mean, that for me is the joy of it. You know, that's the joy of being able to express, and that's the voice, is, you know, the voice of authenticity, and yet every voice for every book can be slightly different depending upon, like, if I went through a very deep process that I allude to in the introduction of this book, which is something I might want to read later. And the process was so interesting to me because, of course, when I wrote Heartbroken Open, which was my memoir through loss to self-discovery, I really was in a deep healing process. So that book was just pouring out of me. But this book had a different kind of process. When they asked me to write this book for the series, I didn't anticipate that it would take me a month to actually sit down to write it. I mean, really a month of processing really what I felt about being a mom, you know, all of the things that I never thought about what it meant to be a mom, and how parts of the job I really didn't like so much, and why I didn't like it, and the parts of it that I loved, and why I loved being a mom. And I went through this very deep process that I had to weed through the muck of it all in order to find that voice, which I felt was the appropriate voice for this book, which was to be a companion friend to moms. You know, I didn't want to sound like the quintessential mom that knew everything, because I didn't, and I didn't know everything when I was doing it, and I don't know everything now, so I didn't want to come across, you know, like that, and I wanted to come across like a friend that, you know, maybe a more experienced mentor to many moms, you know, somebody who's been through it, that, you know, like I said, had so many questions, and now feels like, you know, now that I'm done with the really thick part of it, I'm, you know, have a lot of the answers because of the experience that that came through. So I, you know, I think that was very interesting to me that I went through that, because I wasn't anticipating that.
You know, being a parent is one job that nobody's ever really trained for. I mean,
isn't that the truth?
It's on the job training is what it is.
Yeah, the responsibility is so much, and then I think the responsibility for writing for moms really felt like a lot.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because, well, you had, of course, you had your own personal experience, but every person is different.
Yeah.
And everybody approaches the job a little differently. But,
yeah.
But you had to give some basic ideas of, okay, how do we do this? How's the best way to do this? And that's...
Yeah, and I carry the responsibility of making sure that it's a Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book, you know, because there is a wisdom, and there, like I said, every book weaves back to those five principles of happiness and keeping life in perspective. And knowing that, without having Richard holding my hand this time, you know, I wasn't anticipating that I would feel the tremendous pressure to make sure that this book was as good and as all the other books in the series.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and we're speaking with Christine Carlson, the author of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms. Christine, how, maybe we can talk a little bit about how this book does relate to those five basic principles. In Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms, you reveal how to be a mom, not a friend, how to balance being a woman and a mom, how to pursue your passion but not at the expense of your children, and how to reclaim your family time. Those seem to be the main, four of the main themes in this book. Do those themes relate to your five basic principles of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, every chapter will go back to, you know, one of those principles. And the main thing is just really being able to keep life in perspective, that so much of being an empowered person in this world is really being able to be in choice about how you live your life and how you experience your life. And that's why those principles of thoughts, moods, feelings, separate realities, and present moment living are so prevalent in the series, because they all have to do with really you know, functioning on a very healthy psychological functioning plane. And, you know, really true empowerment, I think, is really knowing that you can make changes in your life. You can practice a new life. You can, you know, shift the way you think about something and see something differently. And, you know, that for sure, if you read every chapter very carefully, you'll notice that every chapter goes to a practice of life. And most of those practices are about personal choice, looking at the, you know, positive side of things, better communication, which always, you know, looking at better communication, you have to really understand, you know, how thought works, how moods work. Like, the last thing you want to do is tackle a problem with a teenager or your spouse or partner when you're in a low mood, you know. So in that way, you know, if you, it's pretty complicated to go through, like, Richard's whole book, You Can Be Happy No Matter What. You kind of have to read it to really, you know, to really understand the philosophy, but you can get it in each chapter in these books without having to know that philosophy. It's just obvious what each chapter is pointing to. So, you know, and there's just a lot of practical things that how to be a mom and not a friend is just something that, you know, that was something that really resonated with me when my kids were growing up, that you could see a lot of moms that became friends with their kids and how very destructive that could be to the teen relationship, you know, that when the mom really needed the authority, she didn't have it, you know, because she had, you know, been too much of a friend and less of a mom. And I always thought that what your kids, you know, your job as a mom is really to be the mom, and that friendship, you know, comes later in life. It comes later as, you know, as your kids are grown and they live their own lives and they're adults. And, you know, and it doesn't mean that you're not friendly. It doesn't mean that you don't have great rapport with your children and you don't play and have fun. It just means that when, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, they know, wow, mom is mom. You know, mom's not my friend because my friend doesn't discipline me on Friday night when I come in late, you know.
Well, you know, the world is, it changed so much, at least from my childhood to
hasn't
now.
It?
And I'm sure from yours, too. It changes so fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, just medically speaking, the things that they can do today, they couldn't do 5 years ago.
Well, and even just trying to address parenting and social media, you know, there are some chapters in this book
about,
if you want to be on Facebook, I'm going to be your friend, you know, and how do we do that in this generation, in this day and age? You know, it's so challenging because kids haven't changed that much, but the world has, you know, and it's just, it's kind of a scary world how exposed everything is how much more vigilant parents really need to be today even than they had to be generations ago because of the internet and because of the exposure of everything and everyone.
You know, you talked about making lists in some of the chapters, but, you know, moms like to make lists, don't we?
And it's almost a necessity, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
The older your kids get, it seems like the deeper the list gets. So, I mean, I definitely think that moms love to make lists and they need to make lists. And it just sort of, and then there's a lot of chapters about maybe you don't need to stick to your list so tightly or prioritizing, you know, what goes on the front burner versus the back burner of your list, you know,
right.
Like maybe your major concerns and issues, you know, really figuring those out, they should be in the front of your mind where a lot of your other concerns can be put on the back burner until another day. You know, they're still going to be there, so.
Well, yeah, you can always move a list from one day to the next. I do that often.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Christine, speaking of lists, did you have a list of topics that you wanted to deal with in the book when you started out?
You know, the publisher asked me to create a list, and I did, and I didn't ever look back on that list as I was writing the book, but I'm sure I hit all of the topics that I had on there. And I definitely... There's really several main threads in the book. One would be mom taking care of herself, you know, mom taking care of her own spirit, communication with toddlers, communication with teens, parenting in partnership, you know, parenting. There's a chapter, A New Paradigm for Divorced and Separated Parents. There are chapters that are philosophical in the book that, you know, help mom to sit down and really see the big picture, take a step back and see the big picture of what she's doing in the long run. And you know, it's got like several themes like that running through it. It was very interesting because when I sat down to order the chapters, I figured out what each of the thread was, you know, so I had like chapters like laid out on the floor and they were all like, you know, in these different themes. And then when I went to order the book, I decided that I would start from the early years and then move through to the empty nest. Mm-hmm. And those chapters would be in kind of a chronological order, but the rest of the chapters are actually woven in very randomly so that there's like little seeds that are sprinkled. Mm-hmm. So that this is the kind of book that you'll figure that order out as you read it, that the toddler chapters are early, the newborn and toddler chapters, and the teens are in the middle, and then the empty nest is at the end. But the rest of them are just sprinkled. And I really love the flow of how this book worked, because you can really feel the threads weaving back and forth very much in attunement with life, that life is like a tapestry, really. It keeps weaving back and forth, and every thread connects and continues on to the next thread.
Now, as you were writing, did you have anyone who you were showing your writing to that was giving you feedback as you went, or did you wait till it was completely done?
Yeah, no, I had a content editor, and her job was to make sure I didn't repeat myself too much. And what I would do was I would send her, you know, about 10 chapters at a time, and she would then make her suggestions and then send them back to me, sometimes with suggestions, you know, what I needed to improve on. Maybe I needed a better example here or there, you know, something like that.
Cool.
Yeah, that's always helpful because you get immersed in it, and yeah, I'm sure you did repeat yourself at times because...
Oh, yeah, for sure. I had a great content editor, and she's fabulous, and that's something Richard never had, but I really felt like it would be super helpful for me, and, you know, she was super helpful.
Well, every writer's different, you know.
How about your kids? Were they involved in the writing process at all?
Yeah, they both were. You know, I would sit, you know, oftentimes and read them chapters and get their feedback, and especially my oldest daughter being a young mom herself, she was full of all sorts of ideas that I should write about.
Good.
All right. Well, Christine, why don't you read the from the introduction to our audience today so we really get a feel for how this book begins.
All righty. Hold on one sec while I get to the introduction here.
As she's looking for that, I'll remind our listeners that this is Writers' Voices, and we're speaking today with Christine Carlson, author of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms, which is just the latest in this phenomenally successful series that has sold over 25 million copies worldwide.
All right, so I'm at the introduction. When I was asked to continue the popular Don't Sweat series with a book for moms, I felt honored and unsure at the same time. It would be the first book to be added to the series, and Richard Carlson, my beloved late husband, the author of the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff and It's All Small Stuff book series, would not be here to celebrate this edition. I was also questioning how could I write a book summarizing what it has taken me a lifetime to learn. In fact, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms is truly a paradox because we moms seem to naturally sweat every detail every day for our families. We are logistics managers, the chief executive decision makers of our homes, nurses, chefs, coaches, and guidance counselors. And many of us do all of this alongside a full or part-time career while being married or single, each of those statuses bringing with it its own challenges. It's no small task being a mom today. The more I thought about it and the more I spoke to other moms, I realized that a Don't Sweat book for mothers was exactly what I would have wanted when I became a mom more than 22 years ago. As I began scratching out a list of ideas for this book, I was surprised by my many feelings about motherhood, my own experiences that came to me. I am now on the other side of raising a family. My nest is empty and my children are grown. Both of my girls are in college now. My youngest daughter, Kenna, graduated from high school last year, and my oldest daughter, Jasmine, will give birth to her second son in a few months. So that makes me a grandmother, too. I have been just about every kind of mom now. I was happily married to Richard Carlson, my soulmate and life partner, for 22 years, and I'm now a widow, 5 years already, which makes me a single nana. Mm-hmm. My children were 14 and 17 when he passed away suddenly. Going through that was in itself quite a journey, but that's a different book. As I worked through this writing endeavor, I realized that there wasn't much of anything new I could share, but instead I found that the time-tested and proven methods of getting through life as a mom with grace, confidence, and an empowered attitude still work. As with my other books, this process was both introspective and therapeutic, as it brought back to me emotions and feelings that had gotten lost in the untidiness and activity of raising children. Feelings of fear and even regret arose as I thought often how I wish I had baked more cookies and cooked more family dinners, that I'd had more patience and been a better listener. I wished that I'd always been wise and responsive and found just the right words to say when I needed them. And that maybe I was not good enough, a good enough mom to write this book after all. My whole identity as a mother was in my face, and as I reflected back, I had to acknowledge that I am not, even now, the quintessential mother who has done a perfect job. I am, however, a woman who has evaluated many of the things that I have done right and those that I could have done differently. I look at my girls today, caring, loving, strong women, and I realize that I got most of it, the small stuff and the big stuff, mostly right. Each chapter treats an issue that I was concerned with at one time or another. I would have loved to have had a book like this as a young mother and would have appreciated the hard-won wisdom that comes through trial and error. In other words, everything in this book is tried and true and built on the don't sweat philosophy that is all about taking personal responsibility for your own happiness, keeping life in perspective, and being gentler with yourself and others while accessing your inner peace and wisdom. I am grateful to have relived my journey as a mom by writing this book for you. Although I have to admit that writing about motherhood is about as much fun as motherhood itself sometimes. Being a mom is a big job, with small and memorable moments calling on our patience and building our character every day. Every day brings a new set of lessons and tests, laced with small joys and a large purpose. Truth is, it's all pretty overwhelming and daunting when we're just starting out. We know that raising small children will exhaust us, and we don't know just what that means, however, until we're there, and that teens will test us. But it's like any journey you take, it happens in small steps, one right after the other. This book is broken down into 100 short, bite-sized chapters to read and think about at your leisure. Did I say leisure?
It's meant
to give you a few new perspectives, ideas, and reminders of the things you may already know, and perhaps even encourage you to make some small changes. When I started out my mom career, I wasn't sure about a lot of things that I know now to be true. If you are reading this book, chances are you're already doing a great job as a mom. I share this book, my memories, and my experiences with the hope you will find inspiration for your heart. And even though I know you take care of the small stuff, I hope this helps you to remember not to sweat what you don't have to. Make the changes you need in order to live the most conscientious, peaceful, and loving life you can. As the mothers of this world become more joy-filled, the heart of every home will be full of love and kindness, and the ripple effect of that will be simply astounding. Treasure the gifts of life and love. Chris.
Thank you, Christine Carlson, who's read the introduction to Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms.
Thank you.
Yes, you know, would you say that the ripple of happy moms goes all over, it goes forever. Yeah. And it goes through generations and through the centuries, because I remember my grandmothers and my great-grandmothers, you know, and I remember them with fondness, and they always seemed to be peaceful and happy, and that's great.
Yeah, I think when kids are raised with love being the main ingredient, no matter all the, you know, all the other stuff that takes place, that love is just, that's what raises really great people, you know. It just raises mm-hmm. great people, and no matter all the little things that happen, you know, they are just small stuff in the end. You know, what really matters is that we really raise our children with love.
Right. You can have a strict household or a permissive household, but if there's love, the kids are going to turn out okay.
Yeah, usually it all works out. You know, everybody's life is a journey. You know, that's another theme that in my own life and with my kids, you know, it's like we can't really aspire to live our kids' lives for them, but we are there to guide them and support them and, you know, and be that source of strength that they sometimes need to get up off the ground when they fall, you know. But the point of being a parent isn't oftentimes keeping our kids from falling down. It's just to assist them as they get up. And to really raise resilient children is to see them as on their own journey, you know, that this is not a perfect journey, that life is not tied up in a perfect box for anyone. And it's pretty messy sometimes, you know. It's pretty messy business raising children sometimes. And it isn't, we wish they came with their own instruction booklet, but they don't, and we don't come with one either, so.
That's right, that's for sure.
You know, it's a journey, motherhood is a journey, raising children is a journey, and our kids are on their own journey too. So I think if it really helps moms to keep that in perspective, that, you know, their children's success or failure isn't a reflection always of the kind of parenting they've done. You know, some of the greatest parents in the world can have kids that struggle, you know.
Sometimes it's
just that's what they're working out in their lives, you know, that they're here to work different things out in their lives. And it's, you know, we just give them the best that we can, and then we have to let go. There's a lot of letting go to be done as a mom, and that's probably one of the hardest things for moms to do, is to let go, because that umbilical cord can be so strong.
That's for sure.
I like to say that my kids turned out really well in spite of me.
That's a great thing to say.
Actually, she gets quite a bit of credit. But one of the things in your intro that you mentioned, you know, how writing this book brings your own identity as a mom, like puts it in your face. And I was wondering, as a Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, you know, as sort of the spokesperson for that whole philosophy, Do you ever have a situation where if you get upset about something, you feel people are going to judge you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's tremendous pressure in writing books like You Can Be Happy No Matter What and Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
I bet.
But, you know, the truth is, the reason why there's not an I in front of them is because it's not that, you know, Richard and I didn't sweat all small stuff. I mean, in many ways, you know, we're like keen observers of the small stuff that everyone sweats, so that we create strategies for better living so that people don't have to, you know, muck through it. They can actually choose through it. And, you know, so I think that's the way I let go of that is, you know, I do my best. I actually am not a person that really lets the little things get to me very much. I'm, you know, very aware that the big stuff happens, and when the big stuff happens, you don't sweat the small stuff. I mean, when the big stuff of life is happening, you know, that's when you have the small stuff all but falls to the wayside and is not even, you know, there's no pettiness in your life when you're dealing with big life issues. And I think if we all keep that in perspective, that, you know, when we have to have our reserve energy to really deal with the priorities and the bigger things of life, and we want to experience the big joy in life, you know, that oftentimes it's the little things that are getting to us that keep us, it's sort of like they sap us out of the present moment, they sap our joy from the present moment if we're focused on the things that are small and petty that have happened and that we can't let go of, you know. that these books are all about really letting the little stuff go that annoys you. You know, it's like understanding that, you know, a small annoyance might be the small dot on the white page. You know, that if you put a dot on the white page and you focus on that little red dot, well, life itself is happening in the white space of the page.
Yeah.
So life is really big. It's a big experience. But if you're really focused on the small stuff, and then you're missing the big life experience that's your life.
Of course, in anything like this, you can go too far on something. I just was thinking, for some reason this morning as I was picking peas, I was thinking about the advice to live each day as if it were your last. I'm thinking, boy, if everyone did that, no one would show up for work.
And well, that's true, except that I think if everyone was really living presently, I think they'd show up for work, because work is really present in your work. You know, work is actually really fulfilling. You
it
know,
is, and I love my work, but if I knew I had one day to live, I wouldn't be going to the office.
Well, no, nobody would. That's so true. That's so true. But again, you know, that's a philosophical, you know, that's sort of about keeping your mortality close so that you really live more fully, because oftentimes you'll find that the most passionate people about life are not people that have their lives all together, but oftentimes you'll find the most passionate people are the people who are told they're going to die. And that's sort of where that philosophy comes from, that, you know, people become very passionate about what they realize they don't have much left of. And
right.
I think if we keep that,
right.
you know, idea just in our tucked in our pocket, it just
yes.
helps us stay a little more awake to not going to sleep to our day-to-day
right.
life.
Because
so
we are all going to die.
To just get stuck in a rut of your routine, you know, and just kind of be like drifting through your life and not really being totally present. So
yeah.
you're right. If you take anything too literally, it could. You're right. Nobody would show up for
right.
work if they knew it was their last.
Well, Chris, can you read one short chapter before we run out of time? Mom, do you have a suggestion
well, there,
of which one to read?
I liked the one because of the new things, especially this bullying thing.
One did you like?
Minimize Your Mama Drama.
So what page is that on, do you know?
That's on page 203.
203. Okay, I will read that one. I have not read that one out loud, so that'll be a pleasure.
Good.
Minimize Your Mama Drama. One of the things I wasn't prepared for in raising girls was revisiting all the mean girl and queen bee drama I thought I had left behind in my own youth. Nothing rekindles your own unresolved feelings like watching your children go through similar and very painful experiences. During such times, it's important to remember to balance your innate desire to protect your children without crossing a line and becoming over-involved and what should be their drama now, not yours. It doesn't occur to us when we are new mothers that we will revisit those hurt feelings of our past hurts through our child. Somehow we hoped our children would be immune from those experiences we never would have anticipated that our lovely, perfect daughters would be whispered about by other girls, excluded from sleepovers, or suddenly dropped by their friends. It's so easy to feel personally attacked when your child is emotionally wounded by another child. It's easy to forget that kids will be kids and that they learn through conflict and disappointment, even though in our minds we may see an act against our child, as unfair or even evil. What happens to our child happens to us because we personalize it. How could we not? But when we do, we are as good as stepping into the drama ourselves, and we never make it better by stepping in. In fact, it's not our problem to heal. I know a woman who learned this firsthand. Her 12-year-old is in the thick of a mean girl drama. Sarah is generally a self-confident girl, but by Friday afternoon, she had finally been reduced to tears by her friend Allison's berating criticism. Sarah wasn't funny. Sarah was a terrible dancer. Sarah wasn't cool. Carly was cool, and Allison and Carly had now forged a fast friendship, and it looked like Sarah was out. The next morning, however, while Sarah was sleeping, her phone buzzed with a text message. It was from Allison with yet another unkind remark. Sarah's mom couldn't resist, and she picked up the phone and began a text conversation with Allison while pretending to be her daughter. She couldn't stand the way Sarah's feelings were being hurt and thought she could toss off a few cutting remarks of her own that would put the girl in her place. Bad idea. She made the situation much worse because Allison figured out pretty quickly it wasn't Sarah she was texting with, but her mom. And when Monday came around and an unknowing Sarah came in for teasing that was more brutal than ever, my friend realized that rather than empower Sarah to say the right things, she had taken matters into her own hands and made this her mama drama. The extent of our involvement with our girls and their friends and the boundaries we set for ourselves isn't always simple. Many of us have met some of our most lasting friends through our children. Maybe they met during the kinder, gentler time of preschool or early elementary school, when relationships between children were more homogeneous, when every child was invited to every birthday party, played on the kickball team, and received a medal at the end of the season. But as our kids age, classes become tracked, bodies change, and so do interests. Some kids develop faster, both emotionally and physically. Not everyone makes the traveling team, the cheerleading squad, becomes editor-in-chief of the yearbook, or has a boyfriend. That is to say, our children age. As they age, they discover that their lives become more competitive. As our children's lives change, sometimes women who met through their sons and daughters and became close friends find that their relationships have changed too, simply because their children are no longer close and it's painful or awkward. Or sometimes two women can be close, but their sons or daughters who are the same age just don't like each other. These are all potential mama dramas, dramas that can be navigated when you agree to accept that that's how things are, and that each child is moving ahead with his or her life in the way that makes best sense for them. Sometimes it's enough to just tiptoe around the topic of each other's kids, silently understanding that you don't want your friend to feel bad about what's happening for your child and not hers, and to just focus on yourself. We moms are, of course, triggered emotionally by the things that happen to our kids that bring up issues from our own bruised childhoods. As I learned to see these emotional triggers with awareness and remind myself that I couldn't recreate my own emotional healing through my daughter's experience, then I remembered to stand behind her for support, but not to participate in her drama directly. I valued my friendships with other mothers and realized that we could all agree not to get involved. There is a fine line between resolving things for our kids and what they need to learn to do for themselves. I learned that it's best to minimize my own personal involvement in my kids' conflicts, maintain a watchful, protective eye, and empower them by giving them the right words to speak, but keep the mama dramas to a minimum.
And
oh,
thank
very
you.
Good.
Thank you, Christine Carlson. And we are out of time. We really enjoyed having you on Writers' Voices today.
Oh, thank you so much. What a wonderful show you ladies have done. And it's so beautiful that you're a mother and daughter and that you do it together as friends.
Yes, that's right.
So let us know when your next book comes out. We'll talk to you again.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, ladies. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. And, Mom, do you have some parting words for us?
Oh, yes, I do, actually. You cannot change the past, and you cannot control the future. The only thing you can control is what you do today.
Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore, and see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.